All financial advice provided on this show is for entertainment and educational purposes only. The financial ideas and strategies discussed are only provided as a starting point for a conversation about money matters. With regard to your particular investments and financial strategies, consult your financial planner, CPA, or investment professional. All your financial decisions are yours and yours alone to make and subsequently are solely your responsibility. The information that is supplied through the context of the radio program and any repurposing of its content by the host or network is a combination and collection of solid financial investment understanding, opinion, and comments. This network, show, and its host are not liable for financial strategies, outcomes that you employ in any manner that result in any kind of loss. Shares of corporate sponsors may be the subject of buy or sell recommendations in Jay Taylor's newsletter in accordance with Jay's objective opinion.
Welcome to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. This hour will help investors fix issues and achieve personal gain. Now, here's your host, Jay Taylor.
Welcome to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor. I'm speaking to you from the borough of Queens, New York City. It is the 29th of November, 2022. And as always, I'd like to thank you for listening to the show and encourage you to send along whatever comments you have about it to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. Questions, the number four, taylor@gmail.com. And of course, we do want to thank our sponsors because they make this show possible. Irving Resources, Novo Resources, Gold Bull Resources, El Oro Resources, Reyna Gold Mining, Lion One Metals, and Timberline Resources are today's sponsors. I've titled today's show, "The U.S. Has Sold Out the American People." James Rickards and Dr. Quentin Henning return. James visits to talk about his latest book titled Sold Out. It focuses on broken global supply chains, surging inflation, and the fastest rise in interest rates in our history. Add to that a Western world that is on the verge of bankruptcy thanks to the overconsumption and undersavings that have taken place ever since 1971, and you have the potential for a global depression akin to, or God forbid, possibly worse than that of the 1930s. Even prior to COVID and the Ukrainian war, Rickards predicted that when this current bubble implodes, national central banks would themselves become bankrupt and thus give way to the IMF that would replace the U.S. dollar as the world's reserve currency with the SDR. It's a unit of currency that would include various currencies and gold. With central banks now losing control of inflation, forcing interest rates dramatically higher, Rickards' prediction that central banks are heading towards insolvency indeed seems to be coming true. Certainly, if you look at the balance sheets of various central banks, they are underwater because they loaded up on low interest rate debt. And as the interest rates are rising, those assets are underwater. And so actually the net worth of various major central banks are now negative. COVID policies and the war in the Ukraine are no doubt accelerating the demise of the existing dollar-based fiat system. I'll try to get an answer from Jim Rickards as to where he sees this current mess playing out, how it's going to play out, and how you can best protect your financial well-being and safety in the turbulent times to come. We do have a very long show today, a lot to talk about, so I'm going to be very brief here and just say that we're going to go to break, but I'd suggest you not go very far away, especially if you're interested in silver, because Dr. Quentin Henning is going to be with me right after the first, right after this break, to talk about El Oro's ISCA world-class silver-tin polymetallic deposit that really is starting to look like a world-class silver mine. It could be one of the largest silver mines in the world. So don't go away. I'll be right back with Dr. Quentin Henning.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit Facebook.com/Voice America.
Timberline Resources is a mineral exploration and resource development company focused on gold discovery in the world-class mining jurisdiction of Nevada. The company's flagship Eureka project hosts a significant gold resource and drill-indicated upside potential at nearby higher-grade targets. Timberline Resources trades in Canada under the symbol TBR and on the OTCQB in the U.S. under the symbol TLRS. To learn more about this district-scale asset with exciting discovery potential, please visit www.timberlineresources.co.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm glad to tell you that Quentin Henning is back with me today, this time to give us an update on El Oro Resources. It's that company's silver-tin-rich polymetallic deposit called the Isca Isca. It's in Bolivia, and it's a project that appears destined, seems to me anyway, destined to become one of the largest silver mines in the world with considerable values of tin, lead, and zinc as well. El Oro trades in Canada under the symbol ELO. You can buy it down here in the States, ELRRF, 70 million shares thereabouts, $2.61 when I last checked earlier today, giving it a market cap around $183 million. Thanks for joining me again, Quentin.
Always a pleasure, Jay.
Thank you. It's so good to have you again. And I do understand, with regard to El Oro, I understand that the company, they put out a press release this morning. It's my understanding that the definition drill program in the Santa Barbara target, that's the main target that they've been shooting at for the last couple of years, that the company is planning to provide a maiden resource in 2023. So I guess have they finished the drilling for that Santa Barbara to enable them now to provide a maiden resource?
Yes, that's exactly right. If you look at the history of drilling at Isca Isca, they started, I think, roughly September of 2020. So we're a little over 2 years into this project. They've completed, I believe, north of 80,000 meters as mm-hmm. of news release. And I think they have a few, you know, say 10, 15,000 meters left of drill holes in the lab. But you're right. They've done a very focused program to drill off an initial resource target area around the Santa Barbara feeder, but also extensions to the northwest and to the southeast from that. So it's an absolutely enormous area. It's a system that has yet to be defined, like the limits have yet to be defined. Mm-hmm. So this is really, whatever they come out with an initial resource here is going to be a starting point. It's not going to be the total mineral system by any stretch. But they're going to come out with an enormous number.
Yeah. So, yeah, I'd like to, if you can give us a little more color on that. For example, can you talk about the Santa Barbara area that will probably be in the maiden resource? Can you give us some sense of the dimensions of that?
Yeah, certainly. Look, they're always good about putting maps on their website. At this point, I think the entire envelope of what they're targeting, which is usually shown, I think, in a red dashed line on their maps, is nearly 2 kilometers from northwest to southeast. So it's absolutely huge. It's about a kilometer wide, or up to a kilometer wide, I should say. And I think some of the deepest drill holes test as far as 800 meters vertically below surface. It is open at depth, but that gives you a sense of the scale. I mean, we're talking about, you know, somewhere between 1.5 and 2 cubic kilometers of rock that have been tested, which is just mind-boggling. Now, it's not to say all of it is mineralized, okay? You know, a subset of that is mineralized. I would say within the you know, let's kind of keep it real here. Let's talk about the Santa Barbara core area there, where they're seeing the high-grade feeder and clearly enough, you know, an increased grade of silver, zinc, lead, and even tin in places. You know, that I would expect to deliver a few hundred million tons, you know, exactly where they're going to land. You know, maybe a half a billion tons. I don't know. But I think it's going to be a big initial number. I think it will grow from there. There's certainly, the geophysics has a huge expression. So there's certainly a lot more area to test. And they, of course, have that tin porphyry likely buried at depth on the south end of the whole system here. So, you know, this is it's going to be an exciting story to watch it unfold. I think, you know, most people don't understand the Bolivian systems because there's not a lot of these in the market. You know, like if you look at publicly traded companies, really, this is the first publicly traded company that has one of these for many, many years. Like Apex Silver way, way back, and this is going back 15 or 20 years ago, had St. Cristobal mine. They developed that property, I think, starting in the mid to late 1990s. And they drilled it up and then took it into production around 2006 or 7, I believe it was. That is a very similar deposit. They, just to give people a perspective, it's a large tonnage. You know, it's like 300 million tons in that case of about an ounce and a tenth of silver, something like a 35 gram silver color, and about 1.5 to 1.6 or 7% combined zinc lead. In the case of St. Cristobal, no tin. There is tin at Iskia, which is a big addition to value. You know, the tin content, even though it's on the order of about 0.1, 0.2%, somewhere in that range, with tin prices where they're at, you know, that is a significant value add.
Yeah, and do you suspect that, I mean, I know they're going to be doing a lot of infill drilling. I suppose continuing to do infill drilling as the project progresses. But do you think two ounces silver equivalent? Have you any sort of sense of what the average grades might be?
I've been keeping track. The mineralized intervals are what I'm focused on. I'm not looking at entire lengths of the drill holes by any stretch. I would say right now roughly 30-40% of the volume of that initial target area that I mentioned, you know, the 2 kilometers by 1 kilometer, 100 meters, I'd say 30% of that volume is looking like it, 30 to 40%, I should say, has mineralized intercepts. You know, so that if you put all those in the bag, kind of do a weighted average, I get somewhere in the neighborhood of 3 or 4 ounces silver equivalent.
Wow. And that's silver equivalent. And how much does tin factor into that?
Tin is a big contributor. In fact, in many places, tin actually, the value of the tin exceeds the silver. So I would say it's at least as important as the silver, if not a bit more.
Wow. And I think you just alluded to the fact that it looks like there might be a richer tin resource to the south. And recently, I believe the company expanded its holdings there in the direction of that southwestern portion of this big caldera, right?
That is correct. Yeah, they've been working on that acquisition, that land acquisition, for quite some time. I think part of the reason they haven't pursued it as aggressively as they might have initially planned is because they were trying to get that deal done and recorded with the government. Now it is able to test it a little more aggressively. It does give them access to the lower topography in that area, so it should be easier to drill that deep target from lower elevations than it would from, say, the top of the mountain.
Well, this certainly does seem to be a world-class deposit, and clearly a lot more work to do. But it seems to me the market's going to want to see this maiden resource. I mean, I'm really anxious to see, you know, what it's going to look like. And then there'll be probably more infill drilling that could maybe make it better even, possibly. I don't know. Worse.
The infill drilling is going to help. It always does. I think it's going to give better definition. Usually in a case like this, infill drilling has very little impact on the overall tons, but what it typically does, at least in my experience, is it usually enhances the grade, because as you do more infill drilling, you start to get better definition on the what would be smaller, volumetrically smaller, but higher grade parts of the system. And those are what can add a lot of, ultimate grade to your overall resource. So I think this initial resource will probably be heavily, you know, inferred and maybe some indicated. There's certainly enough drilling in the core area around Santa Barbara to have some indicated. But I think going forward, you'll see continued improvement as an infill drill. You'll see a continued improvement in the overall grade.
I noticed in today's news release there was some reference to, I think one of the drill holes was a metallurgical hole. drilled for metallurgical studies. Has the company, I think they did some work before on metallurgy, did they not?
They did. They put some initial metallurgical results out. I believe it was within the past half year, maybe in June sometime. That's my guess. And the results were very strong. So, you know, let's kind of step back and look at this thing. Like I said, this is a big low-grade system. So you should think of this more like a porphyry-type system or something, in, at least in terms of its grade and so forth. Okay, so we're looking at basically a suite of metals, including silver, lead, zinc, and tin in this. And you're going to have to produce several concentrates. Okay, the likely outcome is going to be producing a zinc concentrate. That would be number one. The second concentrate would be a lead concentrate, which would capture a lot of the silver. And then a separate tin concentrate. Okay, so you have three different concentrates. The lead and the zinc were flow tested earlier this year, and the results were fantastic. The recoveries, my recollection is the recoveries were in the 80s percent, and that's very typical for a system like this. So I think the recoveries are well, they're telling us that this is well within the range of what should be expected for this type of system. They're low in deleterious elements, so there's not a lot of nasty elements that smelters don't like in there. They're very clean concentrates, and they have a very high silver component. Even the zinc captured some of the silver. So that should mean that these concentrates are widely, you know, sought after in the smelting space around the world. Okay, there's a lot of demand for zinc and lead concentrates. And then as far as the tin goes, the work that they were doing on the tin, I think they did some gravimetric work or gravity recovery, and they were shifting more towards a flotation recovery for the tin, which occurs as a mineral called cassiterite. And the reason for that is because I think it was fairly fine grain. They're finding out the tin mineral, this cassiterite is fairly fine grain, and it's likely going to be that flotation is the better means of recovery. They haven't published any further information about recovery of tin yet, but my hunch is looking at other Bolivian systems in the area, which there are several state-owned Bolivian mines of this type, I would say they should see pretty decent tin recoveries. I don't think there's going to be any nasty surprises there.
Right. There could be some variation, though. As I understand it, the percentage of different metals changes in different parts of this deposit. Is that right?
Absolutely, yes. So it is a zone deposit. Up high, you typically get the zinc and lead and silver. So, you know, if you look at these drill holes, even the ones that came in today, for example, you know, fairly shallow levels, you're seeing high grades of lead, zinc, you know, usually a percent and a half or two or so combined. And then silver's usually in the tens of grams. And then as you look at some of the numbers that are coming from depth, you start to see that tin pickup. So tin usually occurs a little bit deeper, at least in higher concentrations. And that's as you get closer to the source, the, you know, magmatic source for the fluids that generated the mineral deposit itself.
Right. Quentin, let me just a couple of minutes here left to go. This is going to be a big deposit. This is a big deposit, obviously, as you just outlined. It's going to require an awful lot of capital. Are there big mining companies that might be interested in something like this? Because it's not something that I don't think El Oro is going to try to tackle.
Absolutely. Look, there's a lot of companies right now looking for new zinc deposits to develop. Zinc is one of these metals that we often forget to look for as exploration geologists and mining companies. And right now there is a shortage of new zinc mines. Okay, so there's a demand for these things. And I think you're starting to see a lot of companies, you know, the more typical companies like Teck and Glencore and even some of the Aussies like BHP and stuff start to expand in, and Rio expand into these types of deposits. These are world-class deposits. They do require a fair bit of capital. My bet is this will probably be developed at a rate of maybe 50 to 100,000 tons of ore per day. A mine like that might take $1.5 billion to develop or something. So it's not for the faint of heart. It's probably not going to be developed by El Oro, but it will likely be targeted and bought by one of these major mining companies.
Right. Well, I guess just one final question then before we let you go, Quentin. Is the company well-funded? And what are they planning to do after they come out with this resource? Do you have an idea about that?
Yeah, look, they're doing a PEA alongside this resource. The goal here is to deliver not only a resource but also a PEA, either concurrently or shortly thereafter. I think they're going to continue drilling, at least on a limited basis, to test some of these extensions, do infill, and test this porphyry at depth. But I don't know exactly how much cash they have in the bank, but I understand they've got plenty of cash to make it through this MRE. So I think until that time, I don't see any need for capital raise that I know of, at least.
All right. Very good. Well, thank you so much, Quentin, for updating us on this very exciting story. I think if people are looking for a silver play, this is one they might want to take a look at. All right, folks. Well, we do have to go to break now, but don't go away because Jim Rickards will be with me to share his ideas about where the global economy and the markets are headed as we start thinking about 2023 and to talk about his new book titled Sold Out. So don't go away. We'll be right back with Jim Rickards.
Follow us on Twitter at VoiceAmericaTRN. Get the lowdown on guests, new shows, and your favorites. That's VoiceAmericaTRN.
Voice America programs are now available on your favorite connected device, including Amazon, Alexa, and Google Home. Through streams with Apple Podcasts, TuneIn, and iHeartRadio, listening to your favorite show is as easy as saying the show name followed by the word podcast.
Hey, Alexa. Play Finding Your Frequency podcast.
If that doesn't work, try adding on TuneIn or on iHeartRadio or on Apple Podcasts.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really pleased to have James Rickards with me once again. For those of you who may not know James, he is a prolific writer and a New York Times bestseller, author of The Death of Money, Currency Wars, and many more books, including his latest book titled Sold Out, How Broken Supply Chains, Surging Inflation, and Political Instability Will Sink the Global Economy. James has been an advisor on international economics and financial threats to the Department of Defense and the U.S. Intelligence community. He served as a facilitator of the first ever financial war games conducted by the Pentagon. James is with me today to discuss his latest book, Sold Out. Welcome, James, and thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us.
Thank you, Jay. It's great to be with you.
You know, before we get started, I'd like to ask you, I know you're constantly writing books, it seems almost one a year, but if you could tell our listeners if there's some way people can keep in touch with your thoughts on an ongoing basis and not have to wait every year to find out what you're thinking. Is there a place they can go, Twitter or whatever?
Yeah, thank you. I have a couple platforms. I'm very active on Twitter. My handle there is at James G. Rickards. It's RICKARDS, all one word. So at James G. Rickards. Also, I have a newsletter, a number of newsletters, but the flagship is called Strategic Intelligence from Paradigm Press. So if your listeners just Google, you know, my name and Strategic Intelligence or Paradigm, it'll pop up, and there's a link there for those who are interested. You can subscribe, and it's a lengthy piece. It's very good price point. It's relatively inexpensive. Mm-hmm. We produce about 8,000-9,000 words a month. Yeah. So there's a lot there, and I welcome people to have a look at that.
I'd like to start out with a question that Adam Taggart likes to ask his guests, and that is, what is your current assessment of today's global economy and financial markets?
Well, first of all, I like the way you asked the question, Jay, because those are two separate things. The economy is a big subject. I'll address that. But financial markets have a dynamic of their own and have their own sorts of problems. But the economic outlook is not good. We're entering what I expect will be a very severe global recession. There are lots and lots of indicators of that. It looks like the United States had a mild recession, in the first half of 2022. Growth in the first quarter was negative, about negative 1.6% annualized. Second quarter was negative 0.9%, again, annualized approximately. But two consecutive quarters of declining GDP. That's the, you know, the standard definition of a recession. And we had that. Now, it looks like the third quarter, we're going to get that number you know, shaping up. And third quarter is relatively strong. You know, perhaps that recession in the first half was merely technical or relatively mild. That looks like the case. But a lot of the third quarter GDP, and that number is, you know, is coming strong, is inventory accumulation. This is the way they do GDP. It's not all final sales. It's actually inventory. Now, that's a purchase. And if there's some, you know, net margin at the retail level, they pick that up separately. And that's okay as long as the inventory is going out the door in the form of sales. But the smarter economists I know look at those two things separately, and they judge more by final sales. And those are not holding up. So what's happened, I talk about this in my book, Sold Out, but what's happened is, well, I mean, just to go back a year or so, fall of 2021, right? Mm-hmm. Headlines, you know, the supply chain's broken down, Port of Los Angeles is backed up, not enough truckers, you know, et cetera. It's all we heard about. And it was all true. Again, I document all this in my book. But purchasing managers in early 2022 said, well, hold on, if the supply chain's broken down, I can't get what I want, I'll put in a double order or a triple order, and maybe I'll get one third. So I'll order three times as much, hope that I get one third, and my inventory will be about right. But what happened was some of these logjams were alleviated, not completely, but some of them were. So all of a sudden, the triple order shows up just in time for the Fed tightening, monetary tightening, which started in March and then continued through you know, May, June, July, you know, September. November, more rate hikes all along the way, which was destroying demand. And that's a, maybe we can spend a minute on the difference between supply side, supply inflation and demand inflation. Mm-hmm. But the inflation was coming from supply bottlenecks, which we just talked about. The Fed can't do anything about them. The Fed doesn't drill for oil. They don't drive trucks. They don't run trains. All they can do is destroy demand. So you had this, first you have the bottleneck in the fall of 2021. Then everyone orders twice as much or three times as much stuff as they need. The stuff actually shows up just in time for demand destruction by the Fed. So now the warehouses are full. Now that will show up in GDP, but we're not seeing the final sales. And there are reasons for that. The demand side is being destroyed partly by the Fed, partly for other reasons. I know what logistics managers do or sales managers do in that situation. They just start dumping the merchandise because it's very expensive to hold inventory. Cutting prices, doing sales, two for one, whatever it takes, and just getting stuff out the door. So at best, you're selling everything at a discount, which reduces revenues and margins and profits, and that'll show up in the stock market. Mm-hmm. At worst, you can barely give it away because the demand is destroyed. I say if it used to take you know, $70 to fill up your Ford F-150 pickup truck. Today it's $140, you know, relative to where it was a year ago. Mm. Well, people do it. The demand is inelastic. You need the gasoline. You got to go to work or shopping or whatever it might be. But if you spend twice as much, you're not going to spend on something else. You're going to skip, you know, dinner out, a sporting event, a concert, a new dress, a new suit, whatever it may be. And that's where the demand destruction comes in. So the basic economy is a mess. Started with the supply chain breakdown. Then the inflation that we saw. Now, as I talk about in my book, we might even be looking at deflation in 2023. Nobody's looking for that. That's at the bottom of everyone's list, but that could be coming. So it's worse in China. It's worse in Europe. We're very familiar with the energy shortages. I mean, the Germans are just going to freeze in the dark this winter. But seriously, they're out. Germans are out in the woods chopping down trees to get firewood to stay warm this winter. There's no firewood for sale in Germany. There are going to be blackouts. There is going to be rationing of power. They're going to make people set their thermostats at, you know, like the equivalent of 50 degrees Fahrenheit. I mean, they're on a centigrade system, but what we would know is 50 degrees Fahrenheit. People will be sleeping in sleeping bags in their own beds and burning woods. I mean, burning wood, it's almost I'd say medieval, but it's almost, you know, Neolithic. Mm-hmm. Back to the caveman days. Poles are lined up in trucks and pickup trucks and cars. at coal depots to get coal. They want to just shovel coal in the trunk of their car or the back of the pickup truck again. And for days on end, they're sleeping in their cars not to lose their place in line. So the European economy would be in a severe recession. It's already entering that, but with serious consequences. People are going to die of hypothermia. Japan has hit the wall. China, they're not transparent about their numbers. They lie about a lot of what they do, but they're probably in a recession this year, which, considering it's the world's second largest economy and is used to 7 to 10% growth, the idea that they're even in the single digits, let alone a recession, is shocking, but they are. And the U.S. is not far behind. We're looking at a severe recession. So the economic outlook is miserable, and that'll be reflected in stocks. I was going to say, now you mentioned financial. Let's kind of look at that separately. And a lot of people confuse the two. There are recessions in business cycles, and as I expect, we're entering a severe recession right now. But there are also financial crises, which we've seen, 1994, the Mexican tequila crisis, 1998, the Russia long-term capital management crisis. I had a front row seat on that one. I actually negotiated that that Fed-sponsored rescue plan on behalf of long-term capital. 2008, obviously, the global financial crisis. 2020, I don't quite know how to describe that. I mean, the economy goes down 31%. 31%. and you say two quarters. That's the way it shows up in the Commerce Department reports. But it was actually 2 months, March and April, which happened to be in two different quarters, first mm-hmm. and second. Mm-hmm. But it was a two-month, that's what happens when you turn off the light, shut down the whole economy. That's what happens. But then the third quarter, it was up 35% on an annualized basis. So that was just sort of a strange experiment in turning off the lights. But so we have these financial crises, and then we have recessions. They don't always go together. 1990 was a recession with no financial crisis. 1998 was a financial crisis with no recession. The economy was doing fine through all that, even though we came within hours of shutting every market in the world. 2008 was interesting because we had both. That was a genuine deep recession, the worst since the Great Depression, and a financial crisis because we saw the sequential collapse of Bear Stearns, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, Lehman Brothers, AIG, Morgan Stanley was days away from going bust, Goldman was not far behind, et cetera, until the Fed came in, truncated the process, and bailed everybody out. So we just talked about how we're going into a severe recession. Mm-hmm. Is there a financial crisis on the horizon also? And the answer is yes. And you say, well, how do you know that? The signs are there. Nobody's looking, or I shouldn't say nobody. Very few people are looking, mm-hmm. certainly not the Fed. But we see it in the Treasury yield curve. It's inverted. And just for the benefit of the listeners, a normal yield curve is upward sloping. So you have time along the x-axis, you have rates along the y-axis, and the curve of rates at different maturities goes up. And that makes sense. If I'm going to lend you money overnight, I'll have a certain rate. If I'm going to lend you money for 10 years, I might want a little more. You or anybody else or somebody lends me money for 10 years, you're going to want a higher interest rate because there's more risk. It's as simple as that. Well, what does it mean when the yield curve is inverted? It means that rates are projected to go lower mm-hmm. at longer maturity. So wait a second. Why would I take a lower rate for a longer term loan? The answer is I expect interest rates to come down generally. I'm looking for an interest rate crash, which sounds like a good thing, but it's not, because it would only happen if you had a financial crisis of some kind. Even more, a little more technical, same idea, but even more disconcerting, is the euro-dollar futures curve. Now, again, what's a euro-dollar? Well, they're dollar-denominated deposits and loans among big banks outside of the Fed's jurisdiction. So that's what a euro-dollar is. But there's a big overnight market. I lent you overnight, and then we roll it over the next day and the next day and the next day and so forth. So it's a very short-term rate. It's basically an overnight rate. But in the futures market, you can bet on or take a position on what that rate's going to be 6 months from now, a year mm-hmm. from now, 2 years from now, et cetera. So it's a long-term bet on a short-term rate. That yield curve is inverted, and that almost never happens. But the inversion starts around March 2023, where rates go up between now and then. Well, that makes sense because the Fed controls short-term rates. They've told us they're going up. We know they're going up. Just have to listen to them and believe them. But when you get out to around March 2023, they start to go down a lot. And so what does that mean? The euro-dollar market, these are the biggest players in the world. This is not your the retail account or your father's Merrill Lynch account or whatever. Mm-hmm. These are the big guys: sovereign wealth funds, hedge funds, central banks, major institutions in very large dollar amounts, with the biggest banks in the world. So it's serious money. They know what they're doing. And they're saying that rates are coming down starting March. Again, not a good thing. Like, hey, aren't lower rates great for everybody? Well, not if it's because there's a dollar shortage, not if it's because there's a liquidity crisis. So we see, using standard economic indicators of the kind I described, you know, inventories, real incomes are negative, they're going down. Everyone says, Jay, hey, look at the latest report from the Labor Department. Real, income, wages went up 5%. Yeah, they did, but inflation is 8%. Mm-hmm. So your real income went down 3. It's 5 minus 8 equals negative 3, at least where I went to school. So you've got declining real wages, inventory stockpile, which means no new orders, sales slowing, unemployment going up, layoff announcements almost every day. So the real economy is in terrible shape. But it looks like we might have a financial crisis on the horizon also. So it kind of is setting up like 2008, but maybe worse.
I'm just thinking maybe what you're saying might make sense to buy some long-dated U.S. treasuries then.
I would include that in a portfolio. Mm-hmm. And people ask me all the time, oh, what do you do with your own money, or what's a model portfolio, et cetera. And I always explain to people, look, the key is diversification.
Sure.
Now, that sounds obvious, like, oh, yeah, diversification, you know, right. But the people don't really understand what it means. I'll run into people and they say, hey, I'm diversified. I've got 50 different stocks in 10 different sectors, consumer non-durables, technology, semiconductors, mining, minerals, et cetera. And I say to them, you're not diversified. You may have 50 stocks, but you have one asset class, which mm-hmm. is equities. Mm-hmm. And they're all going to go up together or they're all going to go down together. Not every single stock, but by and large, they're highly correlated. Real diversification, have a slice of stocks by all means. Have a slice of treasury notes, and I agree with you. I think 10-year treasury notes at 4.1% yield to maturity, I would say shoot them in, because if the yield curve signals and the economic signals I'm describing mm-hmm. play out, and they are playing out, those yields are going to come down a lot. Mm-hmm. I know they've run up for the last 4 months. I get it. I look at the tickers open all the time. But they're about to turn around and come down a lot. So you'll get very significant capital gains on that. Plus, it's, you know, there's no credit risk or almost no credit risk. I'd have a big slice of cash, and people go, well, what good is cash? There's a low yield and all that. Well, the answer is, yeah, it has a low yield, but you're not going to lose anything. First of all, it'll preserve wealth. Secondly, it could be your best performing asset mm-hmm. in deflation, because the real value of cash goes up. Most importantly, it gives you optionality, which means that if everything's crashing and burning around you and you're the one with cash, you can go shopping. You can pick up the bargains. And a good example is probably no better example, Warren Buffett, Berkshire Hathaway. They have over $130 billion of cash or cash equivalents on their balance sheet. Now, why do they have $130 billion of cash? Because they see what I see. They see what's coming, and they want to be the winners who, as I say, go out and buy the pick through the wreckage and pick up some diamonds in the rough. Then, yeah, real estate, absolutely not commercial. We're not past there's a big transition going on in commercial. It's very tricky ground, but residential, agricultural, natural resources, definitely have some gold. I recommend a 10% slice. People, you know, Jay, they always want to put words in your mouth. They go, Jim Ricker says, sell everything and buy gold. I never said that. I don't think that's a good idea. But 10%, yeah, I do think 10% is a good idea. That's your inflation protection. It'll also preserve wealth. And by the way, I forgot to mention, cash reduces the volatility. It's the opposite of leverage. Mm-hmm. Leverage increases volatility. You can get bigger returns, but you can also have bigger losses. Cash reduces volatility. So if you've got other volatile assets like stocks, you know, gold and notes and so forth, the overall portfolio volatility is reduced by a slice of cash. So that's real diversification. Mm-hmm. That's what I recommend.
That absolutely makes sense. I would gather from what you're saying, then, you believe that the Fed may be going too far in its tight monetary policy at this point.
Yes, I would say they already have. But as usual, the Fed is the last to know. This is just the latest in a long series of blunders going back to 1913. But yeah, they don't know it. And here's why. They're not dumb, you know, in the IQ sense, mm-hmm. but they just have the worst models and they're looking at the wrong indicators. So what is the Fed looking at? They're looking at the unemployment rate, and they see it's around 3.5, 3.6%, you know, and they believe in something called the Phillips curve. Mm-hmm. Now, the Phillips curve says that there's a trade-off, an inverse relationship between the unemployment rate and inflation. So mm-hmm. if unemployment is really low, inflation should be higher because everybody's got a job. If unemployment goes up, inflation comes down. So it's like a seesaw. One side's up and the other side's down. So they see unemployment is really low, which it is statistically the lowest since, it's been this way for a year or so, but you have to go back to the 1960s to find the last time when unemployment was this low. So they assume that that's somehow causing the inflation. Their job is to squash the inflation. And by the way, Jay Powell has been very explicit about this.
Mm-hmm.
So what they're doing, they're raising rates to destroy demand,
mm-hmm.
to squash the inflation, and they're going to do it by increasing unemployment and causing a recession. And that's not a guess. Jay Powell said that.
Yeah.
He said it twice, actually. I guess people weren't listening the first time. August 26th in his Jackson Hole speech, and again on September 21st at the press conference following the FOMC meeting that day when they raised rates 0.75%. And he, you know, in the Jackson Hole speech, he said, he was like Nancy Pelosi, he said, I tore up my speech and wrote a new one, and it was only about 3 or 4 pages long. It was short and blunt. And he said, he used the word pain
mm-hmm.
3 times in one paragraph. I've never heard a Fed chair use the word pain. Ever. He does it 3 times in one paragraph, so and he meant it. Then in September, he repeated the Jackson Hole theme, but much more explicit and just said, sorry, we are going to have a recession. We are going to have higher unemployment. And if that's what it takes to squash inflation, that's what we're going to do because inflation is job one. The problem is, okay, well, all right, they are responsible for price stability. They should get rid of inflation. Aren't they doing the right thing? The problem is that the Phillips curve is junk science. It doesn't exist. You can plot it. I mean, you can come up with a graph and put down the unemployment rate, put down the inflation rate, mm-hmm. but there's no correlation
mm-hmm.
In either direction. And this was proved in the late 1970s. We had high unemployment and high inflation at the same time. From 2009 to 2019, we had low unemployment and low inflation at the same time. Today, we have low unemployment and high inflation. In other words, I can give you a matrix yeah. showing every combination,
mm-hmm.
but if all 4 of them exist, then that means the curve, the Phillips curve, has no predictive value.
Right.
And right now, if you plot it, the Phillips curve is flat. At least where I went to school, there were no flat curves. If it was curved, it was like a curve. So, but that's what they rely on.
Yeah.
So if you've got the wrong model, you're going to get the wrong policy every time. They can't look ahead. Milton Friedman got some things wrong, but one of the things he got right was that monetary policy acts with a lag. So we haven't really felt the impact of the rate hikes that started last March. But they're still going. They are going to, you know, raise again in December. You know, you can debate whether it's 75 basis points or 50. We'll know when we get closer to the date, and probably again on February 1st, which is the next meeting, and maybe after that. So the short answer, Jay, is yes, they are going to continue raising rates. They're fixated on inflation. It will come down, but at a very, very high cost. And meanwhile, when maybe you should be easing up a little bit or at least pausing, they're not. And so they're going to take a bad situation and make it worse.
So thinking ahead, assuming what you're saying is right, it makes sense to me because we're hearing a lot of the guidance from corporations expecting the consumer to be weak as we head into the new year. Everything you say rings true to me. Then it seems to me one of the things you want to do maybe is buy some of the U.S. treasuries in the long end of the curve. How does gold perform in a market like this? Not so good, you would think. What are your thoughts?
Well, you know, the numbers are that since March of 2022, in March of 2022, not long after the outbreak of the war in Ukraine, gold wasn't the all-time high, but it was close. It was about $2,043 an ounce. Prior to that, gold hit 2069, you know, the year before. So since then, it's down about 25%.
Mm-hmm.
So people say a couple things. Hey, Jim, you know, we're asking anybody, but I'm sort of a gold resource. And people ask me, they say, mm-hmm. well, you know, inflation has been the highest in 40 years, which is true. And gold's down 25%, which is true. So what happened? Where's the inflation protection you talked about, et cetera? And there are a couple answers to that. First of all, you know, gold is down 25% in dollars, but the stock market's down between, you know, closer to 30%.
Mm-hmm.
So at least gold has outperformed stocks. That's not much comfort. Down is down. I get it. But, you know, gold is kind of, you know, as I say, it's outperformed stocks and some other asset classes. But the reason gold is not soaring in an inflationary environment is because what I mentioned earlier, this inflation is coming from the supply side, not the demand side.
Mm-hmm.
They're two entirely different kinds mm-hmm. of inflation.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, prices go up according to some index, but the source matters. So supply side inflation is what actually a lot of what my book is about. The book sold out. That's available now through Amazon. It's because of the breakdown of the supply chain. So energy shortages, logistics bottlenecks, not enough truck drivers. not enough truck chassis, actually. There was a sort of a trans-Pacific traffic jam where there were fully loaded vessels in Yokohama and Ningbo, which is the port near Shanghai, that they weren't embarking. Because it was a job, you couldn't unload them in L.A. Like, what's the point of going across the ocean if I can't unload my cargo? So you had a trans-Pacific traffic jam, and all that was true. And it was leading to price increases because, you know, if there's a shortage of goods and inelastic demand, then people are going to bid up the price. Now the other kind of inflation is demand. So the first one, the supply, is called cost push. Second one is demand pull. This is where consumers have it in their heads. It's a psychological issue, maybe real, but it's driven by psychology. The prices are going up. I better go out and buy stuff right away. So you're thinking of buying a car, refrigerator, or a new sofa, whatever it is. Better go buy it today because if I wait 3 months, the price is going to be higher. But that's self-fulfilling because if everybody does that, then all of a sudden there's no more furniture or new cars or whatever it is, and the price is going up. And that's what we saw in the late 1970s. And I lived through that. I remember it very well. I mean, I worked at I was International Tax Council at Citibank, and they would just give you a raise. You didn't even have to ask. They would say, hey, we're going to add, you know, $30,000 to your base salary because inflation. And because they're worried about people leaving and switching jobs and all that stuff. So it was pretty wild time. And of course, gold soared during that entire period. But the point is the demand pull inflation, which I described, which did happen in the 1970s, which is not the case today. We don't have that today. That's the kind of inflation that makes gold go up a lot. Cost push does not. And the reason is that it doesn't feed on itself. It actually pushes in the opposite direction. What I mean by that is if prices are, the example I gave, if the price of gasoline doubled and you got to fill up your tank, there's something else you're not buying. Cost push inflation, you know, the old saying, the cure for high oil prices is high oil prices.
Sure.
Because people stop using the stuff or, you know, they stay home. Or like I say, if you're, sad to say, if you're unemployed, you're not buying any gasoline because you're staying home. And so it tends to burn out more quickly because for bad reasons, which is the economy goes into a severe recession. So that recessionary, and I would say disinflationary or deflationary wave is waiting for us down the road, probably in mid-2023. So that's keeping a lid on gold a little bit. But the other reason, here's probably a more important reason. When people say the price of gold, you know, price of gold is up, price of gold is down, what do they really mean? Well, they're talking about dollars.
Sure.
Because it's, you know, $1,650 an ounce or $2,000 an ounce, as the case may be. So I always tell people gold doesn't change. It's just gold. It's an element, atomic number 79, just sits there.
Right.
What changes is the dollar price of gold, which really says more about the dollar than it does about gold. What has the dollar been doing? The dollar has been getting close to all-time highs. You have to go back to 1985, which was it's as high as it's been since 2000, so back 22 years for starters, when the euro was at 80 cents. I was in Europe at the time. It was great. It was like free, you know, because if you were dollar-based, you were living large. But before that, 1985, what happened in 1985? That was the Plaza Accord led by James Baker, and it wasn't the G7, but it was the five largest economies, including Switzerland, and they got together and they concocted a plan to weaken the dollar. They said the dollar's too strong, and they did. They knocked it down over the next couple of years. Well, the dollar's almost that strong today, but unfortunately, we don't have a James Baker. We don't have the leadership. We got Janet Yellen, who doesn't know anything about what we're talking about right now. She's a statistics geek from Berkeley, knows a little bit about labor economics, but she doesn't know anything about monetary policy or fiscal policy. Or sanctions or anything else. But the point being, she's not kind of aware of what we're describing. You know, she may look at it on a chart, but she doesn't really know anything about it. Leo Brainerd does over the Fed, but she's not in charge of the dollar because that's the treasury shop. So this strong dollar, which is crushing everybody in the world, you know, if you're Turkey or Indonesia or Brazil and you have dollar-denominated debt and the dollar is getting stronger, your debt burden is going up. If the dollar is getting stronger, it's axiomatic that the dollar price of gold should be coming down, which it is because of the strong dollar. So the strong dollar is also a reflection of the dollar shortage, which gets back to what we were talking about earlier in the euro dollar futures, which is behind the curtain of the international monetary system. Big bank balance sheets are shrinking. There's a shortage of actually collateral. You've got, forget about dollar deposits and so forth. In terms of derivatives, you have $1 quadrillion.
Yes.
Of derivatives spread among the euro dollar banks. For those who are not familiar with the word quadrillion, $1 quadrillion is $1,000 trillion.
That's just mind-boggling.
It is. But all that $1,000 trillion, $1 quadrillion of derivatives positions is all supported by collateral. And not 100%, maybe 1% or 2%.
Yeah.
But you need the collateral. The best collateral are treasury bills.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a shortage of treasury bills. Uh-huh. By the way, if I'm Credit Suisse or UBS or UniCredit or one of the European banks, if I want to buy treasury bills, what do I need? I need dollars.
Mm-hmm.
So, and the European Central Bank does not print dollars. That's why the Fed is activating these swap lines. So just to kind of boil it all down, there's a dollar shortage driven by a desire to buy dollar denominated collateral to support this mountain of $1 quadrillion of derivatives.
Right.
That's making the dollar stronger, which is putting a lid on the dollar price of gold.
And it's certainly creating a lot of chaos in the markets. I mean, as you pointed out, if you're Turkey or some of these other countries and you've got to get dollars, it seems like a very unstable system to me, James. And, you know, we're out of time already, and I've hardly begun to ask you the questions I had in mind, but and things that are dealt with in the book. But it seems to me you've talked a lot in the past about a new currency, a need for a new currency. Do you see something like that in the near future?
Yes. In fact, it's already happening. It's something I've talked about for a long time, but now it is happening. But, Jay, I think it's important to distinguish when we talk about new currency, and you're right, that's happening. Distinguish between a reserve currency and a payment currency.
Mm-hmm.
They're different. They can be the same currency, but they perform different functions. Reserve currency, it's going to be the dollar for a while. That's mm-hmm. really mm-hmm. very sticky. It's embedded. And has to do with, you know, for example, the People's Bank of China doesn't have $1 trillion in $100 bills stacked up on pallets in the basement. What it means is that they have dollar-denominated securities in the reserves. The securities are the key. I've got treasury securities. Now, they're denominated in dollars. I needed dollars to buy them. But I don't have dollars. I have treasury notes or mm-hmm. treasury bills. There's no other securities market in the world of that size, liquidity, and then there's a lot else. You need primary dealers, auctions, when issue trading, derivatives, futures, options, settlement, clearance, etc. And above all, you need the rule of law.
Yeah.
It's a big infrastructure, and it's not easy to change or replace.
Or replace, yeah.
When we're talking about payment currency, that's different. You can use baseball cards or bottle caps like we did with your kids. I mean, you can use anything. All you really have to do is keep score and settle up every now and then. And maybe quarterly or whatever. And if you're settling on net, not gross, you need a lot less of, let's call it the real money, to settle up. And you can use gold for that. It doesn't mean a full gold standard, but gold is a good, neutral, widely accepted means of settling net payment mm-hmm. or deficit or surplus situations. But you could have a cryptocurrency. I'm not talking about Bitcoin or anything like it, but something new created by Russia and China and adopted by others, including Brazil and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And you could basically use that to, as they say, keep score mm-hmm. and perhaps settle up in gold. That's already underway. The BRICS now call yeah. themselves BRICS Plus because they've invited Argentina and Iran and Turkey and others to their BRICS meetings. There's something called the Shanghai Cooperation Organization,
right.
Central Asian based. And there's something called the Eurasian Economic Union, as sort of Putin's answer to the EU, also Central Asian-based. The one common denominator in all three of those, BRICS Plus, Shanghai, and Eurasian Economic Union, is Russia. They're a
yeah.
member of all three.
Right.
So they're moving. Russia just opened a rupee-denominated account with the biggest bank in India. They're talking to Saudi Arabia's talking to China about pricing oil and yuan. There's just a lot of ferment in that area, and that is getting traction. They all want to get out from under the dollar because we've abused their trust by freezing central
right.
bank assets.
Right, but the dollar is strong, as you're pointing out, and it's likely to continue getting strong until something really serious breaks, I would think. And James, we're out of time. I can't believe it, but there's so many things in your book that we you know, that I want people to be aware of, and so that they go out and buy the book. For example, I didn't know that, you know, you say why China is actually on the brink of a world historic collapse rather than being a rising superpower. Well, what we're hearing here all the time is China is the biggest rival to the United States. We got to, you know, we got to man up with our military and make sure that they don't get Taiwan. You know, I mean, the other side of the story, which we're not hearing, China's vulnerability. And I haven't read, you know, I haven't read that much about that in your book yet. But these are, there's so many supply chain issues. You get into the intricacies of supply chain issues and what, you know, what that means for the economy and how we should prepare for the world ahead that's described in your book. And of course, that's the kind of thing that all of your books have been addressing, is the practical aspects of how we should prepare our own lives for what you perceive in the future. And you've had a lot of experience you know, obviously a lot of credibility in advising the government and a lot of other people. So any last word, James, before we part? Because I really hope people buy this book and read it, because I think it's so practical in terms of how we should prepare for our lives.
Yeah, thank you, Jay. I really appreciate that. Yeah, the book's obviously on the supply chain. It's got three chapters of how it broke, who broke it, and what's going to replace it, what the new supply chain is going to look like. But it also has a chapter on inflation, which part of which is coming out of the supply chain breakdown, and a whole chapter on deflation, which people don't see coming, but maybe. So it's really an overview. It shines a light on a lot of questions people have. And, yeah, it's sold out, available for pre-sale on Amazon. And it's be coming out in hardcover, but also an audiobook version. A lot of people enjoy that also.
Yeah, well, the book is titled Sold Out, and I expect it will be sold out, James. Thank you so much for spending the time with us. Really great to hear from you again. And I want to try to keep up with you on an ongoing basis a little better on Twitter and so forth. So thank you so much for your time. That's all the time we have for this week. Next week, Jeff Deist of the Mises Institute and Michael Oliver, who writes the Momentum and Structural Analysis newsletter, will join me. Until then, goodbye, and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.